The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and it's a pleasure for me to welcome our guest this evening. The last time Bill McKibben was here, an audience member asked, "What should I tell people who don't believe in climate change?" Bill said, "Tell them climate change believes in them." Unfortunately, climate change believes in all of us, which is why we're here tonight to listen to our guest discuss his new book, Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? I don't want to answer that question, but I can tell you that he offers a critical warning about the dwindling space in which humans can exist. The Boston Globe said Bill McKibben is probably America's most important environmentalist. He has also been called the world's best green journalist. McKibben is the author of the contemporary classic, The End of Nature, among other books on the environment, including the memoir Oil and Honey, as well as the novel Radio Free Vermont. Recipient of the 2013 Gandhi Peace Award, McKibben is the Schumann Distinguished Scholar at Middlebury College and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. It's an honor to have him back. Please welcome Bill McKibben.
Well, Andy, thank you as always. It's a great pleasure always to be in this remarkable building. I was on fresh air this afternoon, and now I'm here, so I feel like I've taken care of the two important Philadelphia institutions in the same day. That pleases me mightily. It's fun for me to be here. It may be more fun for me than for you, I've got to say. This is, at least the first three quarters of it, not a particularly cheerful book. But then I've not been in the habit of writing overly cheerful books, it must be said. I thought maybe what I'd do tonight is try and just sort of talk about what I've learned over the last 30 years. It was 30 years ago this year, when I was 28, that The End of Nature came out, which was the first book about climate change. So, at the time, the first thing that I learned was that scientists, bless their hearts, are conservative. 30 years ago, we knew that we were in trouble. We understood the basic physics of climate change. We knew that when you burned coal and gas and oil, you put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We knew its molecular structure trapped heat. We did not know how fast and how hard this would pinch. And the story of the intervening three decades is, man, oh man, it pinched harder and faster than anyone thought. The things that we're seeing now are what we thought would happen 2080, 2090. We've lost half the sea ice in the summer Arctic. The ocean is 30% more acidic than it was. We're seeing grave disruptions of hydrological systems, the way that water moves around the planet. And I can and do talk and write about these at some length, but there's a kind of just visceral sense of it I want to get across to you. Sometimes you can see it. I mean, I was in Greenland this past summer doing some work, and to stand on the ice sheet, and the great ice sheet, the greatest ice sheet in our hemisphere, the ice sheet that when it melts will raise the ocean 20 feet just on its own. To stand there and watch huge chunks minute by minute break off and fall into the North Atlantic was a remarkable reminder of just the level of the experiment that we've undertaken on this Earth. All of us got to see the pictures from California last fall. And they, by everything we can tell from polling data and things, they really struck home. Watching a city literally called paradise literally turn into hell inside of half an hour is not a picture you can unsee once you've seen it. Everybody could imagine themselves stranded on the road, their car on fire, trying to get the hell out of there. Suffice it to say that what we've experienced is not much compared to what people elsewhere have experienced. The iron law of climate change seems to be that the less you did to cause it, the more you suffer. And so if you go to the poorest parts of the world, there you see just unbelievable change. In the last year, 2018, we had the hottest temperatures ever recorded, reliably recorded on the planet. It got to 129 degrees Fahrenheit in several cities in the Mideast and the Asian subcontinent during one particular heat wave. My oven, you can turn to 130 degrees, so that gives you some sense of how hot it was. Human beings are at the edge of their ability to survive. In some of those places, the humidity was such, because warm air holds more water vapor than cold, that the feels-like temperature was about 165 degrees. Okay. Scientists now are quite convinced that on our current trajectory of warming, vast swaths of the planet, home to 2 or 3 billion people, will see temperatures like that every year and for extended periods of time by later in this century. And if that happens, people won't be able to live there anymore. The human body simply can't cope with that kind of heat outdoors or in an unair-conditioned space for any length of time. You can't go out and work or do business or farm or anything else. And so people will have to move. The UN estimates that somewhere between 200 million people and 1 billion people will become climate refugees by the middle part of this century. When you think about the political upheaval caused by a couple of million people leaving Syria and maybe 1 million people or probably less leaving the drought-stricken Central American highlands over the last couple of years, you get some sense of how fundamentally unprepared we are for the kind of scale of change that may be in the offing. So things got bad fast. That's one of the things that sort of dawned on me over those decades. The Earth was more finely balanced than we understood. We took for granted more than we should have its stability. We've given it a hard push. We're only at the beginning of that process. We've raised the temperature about 1 degree Celsius, almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit so far. On our current path, even if everybody kept all the promises they'd made at Paris, the temperature would go up 3.5 degrees. And of course, some people have decided not to keep the promises they made at Paris. The country that has put more carbon into the atmosphere than any other is also the only country in the world that's decided that it will not participate in the global effort to do anything about it, something that we should all feel a fair amount of chagrin about. Second thing I learned, and this one took me a while, and I kind of kicked myself for how long it took me. Second thing I learned was that we were not really in the argument about climate change that I thought we were. I write books, and I'm a teacher. So my instinct, having written one book about climate change that sort of helped set off the debate and things, was to write some more books about it, because that's what I did, and to give talks and to organize symposiums. And my theory was, and everyone's theory, was that if we amassed enough evidence, then eventually our leaders would have to do something about it, because why wouldn't they, you know? Took me quite a while to figure out that we'd won the argument. By the early 1990s, the world scientists were in robust and confident agreement about what was going on. We'd won the argument, but that didn't matter because we were losing the fight. And the fight was not about data and reason. The fight is what fights are always about, money and power. And the other side in this fight, the fossil fuel industry, was willing to use its money, it's the richest industry on Earth, in order to keep its business model alive another few decades, even at the cost of breaking the planet. That sounds hyperbolic, and I might have been reluctant to say it even a few years ago, because one doesn't want to overstate and exaggerate. But there's been great investigative reporting over the last 5 years. The LA Times, the Columbia Journalism School, the Pulitzer Prize winning website Inside Climate News. They've documented to a fairly well the fact that the fossil fuel industry knew absolutely everything there was to know about climate change back in the early 1980s, back in the period when I was writing The End of Nature. They knew everything about it, which makes sense. I mean, Exxon was the richest company in the world. It had crack scientists, and its product was carbon. Of course they were going to find out what was going on. And their scientists told their executives precisely what was underway. They told them how much it was going to warm and how fast. And they were believed. Exxon began building every drilling rig it built to compensate for the rise in sea level that they knew was coming. What they didn't do, of course, was tell any of the rest of us. Instead, they invested billions of dollars building these phony front groups and think tanks and all of them, hiring people who'd worked for the tobacco industry and so on, building an architecture of deceit and denial and disinformation that kept us locked for 30 years in an utterly sterile debate about whether or not global warming was real or not. A debate that both sides knew the answer to when it began. It's just that one of them was willing to lie about it. And the lie was the most consequential lie in human history because it's cost us the 3 decades that we desperately needed to be working on this, and instead we were paralyzed and largely remain paralyzed. The success of that lie can be demonstrated by the fact that the current occupant of the White House apparently believes that climate change is a hoax manufactured by the Chinese, an idea so delusional that if you were sitting on the public bus next to someone muttering it, you would get up and change seats, okay? And instead, this is the person calling the shots, because that's what happens when you poison the well. And that's why we've had to figure out how to fight ourselves. About 15 years ago, I started writing a lot less and started trying to learn how to organize, which was not my forte. I'm a writer. Writers, by their nature, are introverts. If we knew some other way to communicate, we probably wouldn't be writers. I mean, it's nice to be here with you all, but given my druthers, I'd rather be in my room typing, you know? But it was very clear more books were not going to sufficiently move the needle. So we started trying to figure out if we could do that thing that human beings on occasion have managed to do, build movements large enough to counterbalance the enormous power of the status quo. And so we've tried. And that leads me to the third thing I've learned, which is that a movement is a wonderful thing to have. Now, we started with no idea, it must be said, what we were doing. 10 or 12 years ago, there really was no climate movement on this planet. We started 350.org, which is still really almost the only global group whose only brief is to work on climate change. We started it in the small rural county in Vermont where I live 10 years ago this year. There was myself and 7 undergraduates at Middlebury College. Since there were 7 undergraduates and there are 7 continents, each one took one. The one that got the Antarctic also had to take the internet, okay? And we set out to organize the world. And because of a certain amount of beginner's luck, but more because there was a really unfilled kind of ecological niche out there, it was more successful than we dared dream it might be. Within a year, we'd organized our first big global day of action, and there were 5,200 rallies in 181 countries around the world. CNN called it the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. And I have no doubt that there are a few people in this room who took part in that demonstration in Philadelphia back then and have gone on to do remarkable things here. One of the things that was very obvious and very gratifying to see right at the beginning was that, well, I'd always been told that environmentalism was something that rich white people did, and if you didn't know where your next meal was coming from, you wouldn't be an environmentalist, and on and on and on. I remember sitting in our tiny office watching those pictures come in from that first global day of action, and they were coming in 20 and 30 a minute sometimes on Flickr from every corner of the world. And half an hour of watching them sufficed to demonstrate that most of the people we were working with were poor, black, brown, Asian, and young, because that's what almost everybody on Earth is, okay? And what do you know, they were exactly as interested in the future as anybody here, maybe even more so, because the future presses down really hard on you, as I said, in a lot of those places. And so it was beautiful to watch this movement form and to watch frontline communities more and more take the lead in it, to watch indigenous communities become the absolute sort of fulcrum of this movement all over the world, on this continent, but on every other. That's been tremendously exciting. And it's been exciting to try and figure out, since we had to work quickly, how to go from education, like all those rallies around the world, to kind of expand into the business of confrontation, which again was not my, I mean, I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher. It did not occur to me earlier in my life that I was going to end up many times in handcuffs, you know? But it turns out that going to jail's not the end of the world. It's not much fun, but it's not, the end of the world is the end of the world, which is why one does this kind of thing and why we should be really grateful. Even today, there's hundreds and hundreds of people being arrested in London, closing down Marble Arch and Waterloo and other big parts of the city in what they're calling an extinction rebellion. It's why we should be so grateful for all the school kids led by Greta Thunberg from Sweden who have had these magnificent climate strikes. It's why you should all be prepared and keep an eye out for the fact that come autumn, we're going to be trying and doing some adult strikes too that we're going to need your help with. The kids have done a good job of disrupting education as usual. It's time for the rest of us to disrupt business as usual to one degree or another, because literally it is business as usual that is doing us in. It's simply going down the same path and doing the same things every day and not insisting on the kind of change that we need. We've figured out some tactics that, though they haven't by any means won the fight yet, have begun at least to make a dent in things. Some of you will recall the beginnings now, 8 years ago, of the fight over the Keystone Pipeline. At the time, no one had ever managed to derail a project that the oil industry had insisted on. And no one thought we had the slightest chance. The National Journal, the kind of insider paper in DC, polled its 300 energy experts on the Hill and K Street and things. And 93% of them said that TransCanada would have its permit for that pipeline by the end of 2011. Instead, more people showed up to go to jail than had committed civil disobedience about anything in this country in many years, 1,200 and some people. By the time that first siege was over, it was a national issue. And now for a decade, we've managed to keep them at bay, though Trump continues to do everything he can to build this pipeline. For a decade, we've kept 800,000 barrels a day of the dirtiest oil on Earth underground, which is good. More to the point, the simple demonstration that it was possible to stand up to these guys led people to fight every single pipeline, oil port, frack well, coal mine, everything that you could imagine all over the world. There have been enormous fights, obviously, in Pennsylvania, where we got started too late in some ways. And this beautiful state got fracked to within an inch of its life before people could muster themselves as they did in New York State and managed to shut down the possibility of that kind of destruction. There are pipelines that people are fighting here. People continue to fight a brave battle against Philadelphia's incredibly outdated idea that it might become an energy hub, a kind of fossil fuel energy hub. I mean, look, that's an idea that makes the Liberty Bell look modern and up to date, okay? Going all in on fossil fuel in 2019 is about as bad an idea economically as you could ever imagine. So people, keep up the fight, and thank you for doing it. We don't win all those battles, but we win some of them. And every time we fight, we slow down the other side, delay them, cost them money. And while we're doing that, this is the important thing, our colleagues in the engineering departments are doing their job too. They've dropped the price of a solar panel 90% in the last decade. Sun and wind are now the cheapest way to generate power almost everywhere in the world. So if we can stop, slow down, delay, get in the way of the fossil fuel industry, even a little while longer, the spreadsheet looks worse with each passing day. We're at this moment of extreme transition. It's not that we're clearly going to run the planet on sun and wind in 50 years because it's free, okay? And even Exxon can't hold out against that forever. But they can probably hold out against it long enough to ensure that the planet we run on sun and wind in 50 years is a broken planet. So our job is to speed up that transition, to make it happen much faster than it otherwise would. And we have lots of tools. The only other one I'll talk about is the campaign that we launched 7 years ago for fossil fuel divestment, to get institutions to sell their shares in coal and gas and oil. And the earliest example of this fight actually was at Swarthmore, not far away, where somehow the trustees of that theoretically Quaker institution have managed to hold out against divesting all these years and continue to take their enormous endowment and pour it into fossil fuel stock. Happily, all around the world, others have made a different decision. This has now become the biggest corporate campaign of its kind in history. We're at the point where endowments and portfolios worth $8 trillion have divested in part or in whole from coal and oil and gas. We're now seeing massive institutions. The New York City Pension Fund, which was $200 billion, divested last year. The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is literally the largest single pool of money on Earth, $1 trillion that came from its North Sea oil exploration over the last 50 years. They're divesting. The entire nation of Ireland last summer announced that it was divesting all public funds. That's good, and it's taking its toll. Shell Oil said last summer that divestment had become a material risk to its business. Last week in Houston at the big fossil fuel conference, Politico quoted a bunch of coal executives saying basically that they could no longer find capital to work with anywhere, that too many funds had divested. There really was nobody to lend them money at reasonable amounts to keep expanding coal mines and so on. So thank you so much, people who have done this kind of work. The fourth thing that we've learned is that we do not know how this is going to turn out. This is the first human experience in a way like this, I think, where we don't know how it's going to turn out. Every other fight we've had, we had the luxury of time. So Dr. King would say at the end of every talk, quoting from the abolitionist Theodore Parker, he'd say, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. This may take a while, but we're going to win. The arc of the physical universe, on the other hand, is short, and it bends toward heat. And if we don't win quickly, then we will never win. this is the first timed test for human beings. And so far, obviously, it's a test we're failing, and failing pretty badly. And we've got to do much more. We have the technologies that we need, and maybe we have the movements that we are at least beginnings of what we need. Maybe we're able to exploit the other great invention of the 20th century, nonviolent movement building, to figure out how to stand up to this power and turn it around. I don't know. We will see. And we will see in the lifetimes of everyone in this room. It's not like this decision is going to get made 50 years down the road. There'll still be plenty of work to do 50 years down the road, but if we're going to get to the point where there's still work to do 50 years down the road, we have to win the next 10 years. I mean, this is the time that we have, which is why it feels to me so urgent, and it's why I end up sometimes in jail, and why everybody needs to figure out what they can do that takes them outside their comfort zone, because the planet is way outside its comfort zone. And the things that we're doing so far, the things that have been relatively comfortable for people to do, clearly aren't enough. So we need people to dig deeper and figure out precisely what it is, and it'll be different for different people, that they can muster now. This is the question of our time. It's useful to remember that other people in other times have faced difficult questions too, you know? I mean, look, our parents or grandparents had to deal with the rise of fascism in Europe, which meant they had to cross the ocean and either kill people or get killed. So that's harder than figuring out how to get a lot of solar panels and wind turbines put up, okay? This is a doable task that's before us, but it takes commitment, energy, work. And I'll finish by saying, and maybe I'll actually read a tiny bit from this new book, which this is the first time I've tried to read from it, so sorry. I want to end by saying that I think it's deeply worth the fight. And because the planet is a very beautiful and special place, and because our species is a very beautiful and special species. The very end of this book is a defense of the idea of human solidarity in a lot of ways. One of the people who's kind of a running villain in the book is Ayn Rand, the libertarian philosopher, who turned out to be maybe the most important philosopher of our time, in that all the most important, powerful people in the world lapped up her ideas about greed being good and altruism being bad and so on and so forth. And some of the people who've lapped them up the hardest are not just the Koch brothers and so on, it's the Silicon Valley titans who have no interest in anybody regulating them, want to do what they want to do. And one of the funny things it turns out that they all seem to want to do, all the 10 richest guys in the world, is leave, you know, build rocket ships and go into orbit. As one of them said, and I quote him in the book, in space, no one can make you pay taxes, you know, so there you are. I grew up in the 60s. I was 8 years old when we landed on the moon. So I've always had this sort of, you know, that kind of relationship with that idea. And I went down to Cape Canaveral as I was finishing up this book to watch the launch of one of Elon Musk's rockets into space. And it was beautiful in its way and powerful, but what was much more powerful was actually what I did the day before. The day before the launch, I went on a tour of Cape Canaveral with a couple of people who worked there, a guy named Greg Harland and a guy named Don Dankert, who had overseen the rebuilding of the dunes along the Atlantic shoreline of the Kennedy Space Center. Now, I'd been warned in advance not even to raise the topic of global warming with them, which was fine with me. I didn't want to get them fired. And in any event, there was no need because the problem was blindingly obvious. We climbed up a small hill overlooking Launch Complex 39, where the Apollo missions left for the moon and where any future Mars mission would likely begin. The ocean was a few hundred yards away, which is perfect in the sense that launching rockets here on the East Coast means that the Earth's spin helps put them into space, and that if something goes wrong, they fall harmlessly into the ocean. But not so perfect given that the sea is now rising fast. NASA started worrying about this sometime after the turn of the century, forming a dune vulnerability team. The worry accelerated dramatically after Hurricane Sandy in 2011. Sandy didn't hit Cape Canaveral, it hit New York City and these parts of the world. But even at a distance of a couple hundred miles, the great storm churned up waves strong enough to break through the barrier of dunes and very nearly swamp the launch complex. Dunes that had been previously stable for decades, suddenly they were gone. And so those dunes were rebuilt. This guy Dankert had not only found the millions of cubic yards of sand, they excavated them from a nearby Air Force base, but he himself planted the last of the 180,000 native shrubs to hold the sand in place. And so far, the new dune has performed, yielding little ground in the face of recent hurricanes. So perhaps until a few more chunks of the Antarctic crash into the drink or a bigger storm hits head on, our escape route to outer space is safe. But what impressed me more than the new dune was the sheer affection these two men had for the landscape where they worked. Kennedy Space Center is the Merritt Island Wildlife Refuge, said Harland. We use less than 10% for our industrial purposes. When you look at the beach, it's like 1870s Florida, the longest undisturbed stretch on the Atlantic coast, Dankert added. We launch people into space from the middle of a wildlife refuge. That's amazing. They talked for a long time about their favorite local species, the brown pelicans skimming the ocean just off the beach, the Florida scrub jays, the gopher tortoise. When they were rebuilding the dune, they carefully bucket trapped and relocated every last one of the tortoises. Before I left, they drove me half an hour across the swamp to a pond near the Space Center headquarters building just because they wanted to show me some alligators, and we could see snouts surfacing near the bank. But at each corner of the pond, I was more interested in the sign that had been carefully placed. The alligators in this area occur here naturally. They were not placed here. They are not pets. Putting any food in the water for any reason will cause them to become accustomed to people and possibly dangerous. And if that should happen, they must be removed and destroyed. Something about that sign moved me tremendously. It would have been easy enough to poison the pond, just as it would have been easy enough to bulldoze the gopher tortoise. But NASA didn't, because of a long series of affectionate laws that drew on an emerging understanding of who we are. John Muir, in some ways the first self-conscious Western environmentalist, crossed Florida on his 1,000-mile walk from Louisville to the Gulf of Mexico in 1867, a trip he used to form his first heretical thoughts about the meaning of being human. From his diary, "The world, we are told, was made especially for man, a presumption not supported by all the facts. A numerous class of men are painfully astonished whenever they find anything, living or dead, in all God's universe, which they cannot eat or render in some way what they call useful to themselves." His proof that this self-centeredness was wrong was the alligator, numbers of which he could hear roaring in the swamp as he camped nearby, and which clearly caused man mostly trouble. But the alligator was wonderful nonetheless, Muir thought, a remarkable creature perfectly adapted to its landscape. "I have better thoughts of those alligators now that I've seen them at home," he wrote. Indeed, he addressed the creatures directly. "Honorable representatives of the great saurian of an older creation, may you long enjoy your lilies and rushes and be blessed now and then with a mouthful of terror-stricken man by way of dessert." Most of us don't go as far as Muir. We still wince when we read of some gator emerging from the water hazard on the sixth hole to chomp down on an unwary golfer. But his basic idea that all of creation matters has made some real headway. That evening, Harland and Dankert drew me a crude map to a beach where I could wait the hours until the pre-dawn rocket launch, a beach where they said I'd be likely to spot a loggerhead sea turtle coming ashore to lay her eggs. And so I lay on the sand, north of Patrick Air Force Base and south of the sign erected by the Brevard County Historical Commission to commemorate that here in 1965, Barbara Eden emerged from her bottle to greet her astronaut at the start of I Dream of Jeannie, the last sitcom filmed in black and white and certainly a key feature of my early intellectual life. The beach was deserted, and under a near full moon, it was easy to see a turtle trundle from the sea. She lumbered deliberately to a spot near the dune where she used her powerful legs to excavate a pit. She spent an hour laying eggs, and even from 30 yards away, I could hear her heavy breathing in between the whisper of waves. And then, having covered her clutch, she tracked back to the ocean in the fashion of others like her for the last 120 million years. We are messy creatures, often selfish, prone to short-sightedness, susceptible to greed. In a Trumpian moment with racism and nationalism resurgent, you could argue that our disappearance would be no great loss. And yet, most of us, most of the time, are pretty wonderful, funny, kind. Another name for human solidarity is love. And when I think about our world in its present form, that is what overwhelms me. The human love that works to feed the hungry and clothe the naked, the love that comes together in defense of sea turtles and sea ice and of all else around us that is good, the love that lets each of us see that we're not the most important thing on earth and that makes us okay with that, the love that welcomes us imperfect into the world and surrounds us when we die. Even, especially in its twilight, the human game is graceful and compelling. So there I end. Thank you all very much. Now, Andy kindly has left me this, because the last book that I came here to talk about, this funny little novel that I wrote about Vermont seceding from the Union, was actually kind of a hymn also to our biggest local industry in Vermont. We have more breweries per capita than anywhere on earth, and I'd been boasting about it a little bit, so he was determined to show me that Philadelphia was in this race as well. So I'm going to actually open this excellent Yards Pale Ale and enjoy it while we do a question or two.
Thank you for your talk. When you were here last time, I was mentioning a suggestion that is to bypass Congress and go right to industry. And you said, Steve, I'm way ahead of you. I'm talking to the head of Duke Energy, I think his name Roger or something like that. I'm wondering how that's going because, again, we got to get moving. We have like 11 years to save the planet. And it'd be best if we could get Congress and even the Duke brothers and people like that on our side. But I'm saying, what luck are you having just bypassing Congress and talking to actual people? And it may be in their selfish self-interest to cut coal use because the plants are old and inefficient, but that's okay. If they're cutting the plant out, I don't think we really care why. If they're going to some kind of energy efficiency or renewable energy, that'd be good.
So that's a good point. And there's been some progress, at least around the edges in certain places, as the price of renewable energy has gone way down. Utilities have begun to build more sun and wind power and have begun to, you know, despite Trump's rhetoric, coal plants are continuing to be retired at a pretty fast rate because coal's expensive. But it hasn't acquired the momentum that we need. What's happened much too often is that people have replaced coal with natural gas, which it turns out is not an improvement. I mean, between the carbon that emits when it's burned, less than coal, and the methane that is produced when you frack for it, more than coal, it's pretty much a wash. That's one of the reasons that basically U.S. greenhouse gas emissions didn't budge during the Obama years. Carbon went down and methane went up. And at the moment, it's continuing. Things are continuing to go up. So people continue to work with industry. And I, you know, it's funny. I try my best. I was out last week with the heads of the heads of the fashion industry of all things. Not a place where I would normally, you know. end up, but important because we think that, you know, there was a recent study that said that the fashion industry alone, just because we go through so much clothing, throw away, so just sort of churn our way through, would use up 26% of the available carbon budget between us and 2 degrees. I mean, it's a, lots of industries would use up 26% of the budget. It's a vastly oversubscribed budget, okay? But so, but significant. So, I mean, was talking to them and they were willing to make some sort of changes around the edges. We can figure out how to grow cotton with less water and but yet the ability to sort of get at the heart of things and say, huh, maybe we need to come up with a kind of new paradigm for this industry that doesn't rely on people throwing away 80 pieces of clothing every year, that's hard for them to figure out. It's one of the reasons why it's so useful that we have this Green New Deal proposal before us. Not because it's going to pass right away. You're right, Congress, I mean, the US Senate is where good ideas go to die, you know. But because it helps people understand the scale of the problem that we face. It's going to take something on the scale of the last New Deal to pull us out of this. And I'm actually extremely heartened to see how much this is now we've managed to insert this into our political discourse. We used to worry every election cycle, we'd fret endlessly about whether we could get them to ask one question about climate change at the presidential debates, and we never could. They never did. That's not going to be a problem this year. It's the absolute front and center of the Democratic debate, and people are doing remarkable things. Senator Warren today proposed a plan to end all drilling and mining on public lands in the US, which was very, very good to see. And whoever wins the Democratic fight, they're going to ram this issue straight down Donald Trump's throat, because every bit of polling shows that almost nobody believes his nonsense that it's all a hoax. People hated that we pulled out of Paris. They understood the irresponsibility of that. So we may be at a point where now where there's some real political inflection possible. We'll see. You know, obviously the fossil fuel industry, wounded animal though it is, retains enormous power to do damage, and so we don't know how it's going to come out.
I would love to go out and have a beer with you and ask you all my questions, but I'll ask this one, which is there, we have found there are natural ways that we can help improve our environment. But you also then hear Exxon and other people talking about carbon sequestration. And are there, as well as doing all the natural things we have to do, is there anything that industry can do?
So that's a good question too. And the answer sadly is probably not on any scale that matters, okay? Now, it's not that it's physically impossible. You can build a system, you can connect a system to a coal-fired power plant that captures the exhaust, which is mostly carbon dioxide, and pumps it underground into an old, well, often what they do is pump them into old oil wells so they can displace oil and pump more oil. But you could also put them in a salt mine or something like that. The problem is, as you might expect, it's unbelievably expensive to do this. You have to build, to capture all the carbon in the world, you'd have to build a piping network larger than the one we've built over the last 100 years to get oil out of the ground. And once you do it, the price of electricity that comes from that coal-fired power plant that's been replumbed, you know, to take the cost of electricity from that is through the roof. So you're way better off just building a windmill in the first place, okay? You get no carbon and it's much cheaper. The only reason not to is because if you're Chevron or somebody, you have this, you know, stash of natural gas or that you want to keep burning. And so you'd be grateful if the people of the United States would pay huge sums of money to help you build this project to sequester carbon. Having said that, there are really powerful natural ways to sequester carbon that we're learning more about. Soil can absorb an immense amount of carbon if you treat it somewhat differently than we've treated it over the last 100 years. We've taken most of the carbon out of the soil, a combination of chemical agriculture and monocropping and things. But it's possible to not only put some of it back in, but to sequester a lot. So in 2015, the French government passed a law, they called it the 4 per 1,000 law, that incentivizes and helps farmers to increase the amount of soil in their carbon by 0.4% every year. And it's been successful so far. People have figured out lots of ways to do it, and in fact, to do it faster. If we could scale that around the world, it might well take, I mean, the estimates at the sort of high end are we could take 40 or 50 parts per million CO2 out of the atmosphere, which would be good. But it wouldn't in any way obviate the need to stop pouring more in. I mean, the biggest problem we face is that we're still, the spigot is wide open and we're pouring more carbon into this bathtub. So even if we can figure out ways to enlarge the drain somewhat, we're really never getting ahead of the game. So we got to do both. And there are interesting ideas about how to do it that are emerging.
So one of the cracks against the Green New Deal is that they're going to take away our hamburgers. Mm. But given the role that animal agriculture plays in all of this, that's probably what needs to happen. So I wanted to ask what advice you would give to a plant-based food advocate, where to turn.
Absolutely. So eating lower on the food chain is a big help. So this is the place where I want to explain why I organize the way I do. And this is a good way to sort of example to make of it. About 0.5% of Americans are vegans now, okay, which is good. And if we had a huge organizing drive, I mean, I've done some organizing now, so I have some sense. And if we put all our effort behind it, it seems to me we could increase that 10 times over the next decade and have 5% of Americans as vegans. It'd be hard because, you know, bacon is a big deal and, you know, on and on and on. But we could do it, I think. And if we did, that would help, but it wouldn't help that much. You know, you'd have 5% of people not producing the 20% of emissions that come from agriculture, roughly. Okay. So because we have this timed test, what I try to do is figure out those places where there's leverage, where you can take 5% of people and use them to change some of the systems and structures of our society in ways that produce much larger changes. To get back to the question around agriculture, current industrial agriculture is more dependent on cheap fossil fuel than just about anything else we do. Basically, we grow food now by just pouring oil on it. You know, that's how we grow food. And so if we were managed to structurally change things, say, for instance, so that there was a reasonable price on carbon, or so that we weren't pulling as much of it out of the ground, and it'd be one of the first consequences would be dramatic changes in some of the ways we do agriculture. We'd move it just as we're moving energy towards a more localized and somewhat smaller scale. And it would probably require, I mean, at the moment, 1% of Americans farm. We have there's twice as many people in prison in America as there are farmers, okay, which tells you something about our justice system and our agricultural system, okay? We'd probably need some more people farming because what we basically did was replace human judgment and labor with oil. But to me, that's probably, given the short time we have, the better bet. On the other hand, I'm always eager to see people organizing, and if people can get good things going that seem to be catching on and making a difference, I'm happy to help. The people that I've been working with the most in this realm are an interesting bunch who call themselves not vegans or vegetarians, but reducitarians. And they've published a series of interesting books and had a bunch of, and seem to be getting some traction in convincing people to eat half as much or a third as much meat as they used to. My guess is that just mathematically, you might be able to get 30% or 40% of Americans to eat half as much meat, which statistically would get you farther than having 5% of us vegetarians. And you could do it because there's a lot of arguments you can make about health and about food and everything else that help get you there. And you don't run into quite the same cultural problems that you do. I mean, one of the things I've noticed traveling around the world, especially the poor parts of it, is that there are a lot of people just entering the phase where they get to eat any meat at all, and man, do they like it. I remember sitting, I don't know, 10 years ago in a slum on the outer ring of Beijing. I'm sure by now that slum is more or less in the center of Beijing because it keeps growing more and more and more. And I'm sure by now it's filled with, it's no longer a slum and, you know, it's whatever. But there was an old man there, and I was talking with him, and he had just recently moved to this slum from the countryside. I said, "Why did you come?" He said, "Oh, he said, my village was very poor. We had no meat and no alcohol. And now I'm here." And I was like, "Okay, I'm glad I asked you that question because it gave me a sort of good reality check on, you know, how we're going to live." So very good question, and thank you for your work in this regard.
This is a more specific question. Mm. I've been looking at electric vehicle charge stations, and the four or five companies that manufacture these, each seems to put its own adapter out with their charge stations, and they don't fit all the electric vehicles that are on the road. Would you or would somebody please knock their heads together and get them to stop putting barriers
in the
way?
Yeah, we'll keep trying. I think we're getting there. The main outlier at this point is Tesla, who has its own series of superchargers. Everybody else seems to be converging on the same thing, and one imagines that, I mean, Elon Musk is on the one hand a brilliant guy who's actually accomplished a fair amount of good in the world, and on the other hand is an arrogant son of a bitch at, you know, just an amazing level. So one will keep having to kind of push him, and I think eventually they'll figure out the logic of it. Don't let it keep you from buying an electric car, because they're getting better by the minute. And in fact, I was just reading today a really interesting story from some car guys, not like environmentalists, but car guys, saying that people who are buying new cars now might want to be careful about buying an internal combustion engine, because 7 or 8 years from now, there's going to be no resale value for it at all, because we're going to have made such a decisive switch to electric vehicles. The reason being, maybe because of carbon and environmental stuff, but definitely because they're better cars. Like, the thing about an electric car that's really going to carry the day is there are almost no moving parts. There's very few things to go wrong in them. That's why auto dealers don't really like them, because that's where they make their money servicing things. But that's where we're going. And so it's just the right thing to be thinking about. There's some kinks to be ironed out for sure.
Thank you so much for your talk today and all of your work in general. Getting involved with 350 and the KXL divestment work in college was my foray into environmental organizing.
Good for
you. So thank you. And after graduating, I have spent the last 3 years doing climate organizing professionally. I, of course, like all of us in this room, really care about it. But as a young person that knows I'll have to, you know, I'm scared of what the future will look like, and trying everything I can to stop this crisis, it's hard. It's really hard to see, you know, even our state legislatures here in Pennsylvania is filled with climate deniers to this day in 2019. And so my question for you is, as someone who's been doing this since, you know, the 80s, what keeps you going? What gives you hope to keep fighting?
So it's a really good question, and it's part of why I wrote this book. And thank you so much for your work. And thank you so much for being representative of the people who really are doing the work now. I mean, look, around the world, it's young people who are leading this fight. The people who are doing the Green New Deal are the people who figured it out and are organized. It are called the Sunrise Movement. And they make me extraordinarily happy, because they're almost all veterans of the divestment movement on campus, you know. And they're now like 24. And there, I had a cooked dinner the other night for a couple of friends of mine who run the Sunrise Movement. And they're a little freaked out, because now they're looking over their shoulder and there's all these 12-year-olds who are like, you know, out there organizing or whatever. So that's really good. What keeps me going, in part is sort of what I was ending in this book, it makes me mad. Some days when I'm feeling like we're not getting anywhere, the only thing that keeps me going is the pleasure of making trouble for the oil companies. There's days when I'm like, we're not going to win this, but I can make life harder for Exxon, and that alone is worth it, you know. But what mostly keeps me going is this sort of sense that that we should be able to do this. Like, we've got the big brain. You know, the scientists gave us the warning in time. The engineers have done their job. If we're the species that we could be, then we should be, this is our chance to prove it and demonstrate it. And it just seems so relentlessly sad to imagine just losing it all because we couldn't bring ourselves to, like, stand up to, you know, Exxon. And it just seems like, oh, so pathetic. And the other thing that keeps me going is just, and you found this, just the kind of wonderfulness of this movement. I spend a lot of time all over the world. I'm very lucky in getting to see it kind of up close all the time. And the thing that strikes me is how often the people who are in the lead are people who've done nothing to cause the problem. And yet they're willing to work with us side by side. The book is dedicated to one of my very favorite people in the world who died much too young a couple of years ago, who led our work in the Pacific, a woman named Kareti Tiamalu, who set up, she was from Fiji, and she set up this thing called the Pacific Climate Warriors, and they're the best climate activists almost that I know in the whole world. I wish I had a picture to show you. My favorite thing they ever did was on each of these low-lying islands that's almost certainly going to disappear this century. Tuvalu, Vanuatu, the Marshalls, Micronesia, the Solomons. Each one of them, they built a traditional canoe, took down a tree and built a canoe, and they took them to Newcastle in Australia, which is the biggest coal port in the whole world. And they used them for a day to blockade the biggest ships in the world, these giant ore carriers, and keep them in the harbor. And there's a picture of one of these guys in traditional costume in this traditional canoe there with this unbelievably enormous ship looming over him, you know, that he's in the way of, that has to turn around because it, and when I saw it, the thing that flipped in my mind, because I'm a writer, and so I think in terms of the kind of tropes that all human beings, I think, respond to, was just the perfect example of the small and the many against the mighty and the few, okay? Which is, I mean, that's a kind of just basic, it's like the Death Star versus the Rebel Alliance, you know? A few weeks later, I was in Seattle, where our crew, wonderful organizers, got thousands of people out in the harbor in small craft to block Shell's 40-story drilling rig that they wanted to take up to the Arctic and open up the Arctic for oil drilling. Think about that for a minute. Scientists said, if you keep burning oil, you'll melt the Arctic. When the Arctic melted, Shell didn't say, huh, maybe we should go into the solar panel business. It said, huh, now it'll be easier to drill for more oil in the Arctic. Okay, that's about as low as it is possible to get, all right? But anyway, these people got in the way in their little boats. Of course, we called them kayaktivists. And it was the same thing, the mighty but the few against the small and the many. That's the drama of the moment that we're in, and you get to be a huge part of that drama. It's pretty rare for a human being to be able to say, I'm actually doing the most important thing I could be doing in the world. Most human beings never get anywhere near being able to say that. But you, with the work you're doing, can honestly say that, you know? And it's a good feeling. So thank you very, very, very much for it. It's 8:30, and I think actually that's precisely the note on which we should bring this to a close. I just really want to say thank you to you all, and if you want, I'll sign a book or two or whatever, but bless your hearts.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.